this means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th. Rabia here this week, and I am joined with Siraj Hashmi. Hey, Siraj.
Hey, Rabia. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Can't complain. This past week is a little bit crazy between, the Kavanaugh hearings and then just everything going on in a shortened work week. You know, four-day work weeks are just the worst.
That's true, that you got to squish it all in. But the weeks have been crazy for the last year and a half now. But forget that. Before we get to that, at least, tell me about what's new. I think there's some new career developments going on with you, aren't there?
I mean, I've been hosting a few TV shows. I hosted the McLaughlin Group, just following them for Tom Rogan, who has joined the show at one point in time. But you know,
congratulations. Well, that's awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, it was a one-time thing, and there might be an opportunity later in September. But beyond that, you know, for the most part, things have kind of remained the same. It's just now I'm going to host TV shows, which is cool.
At some point, Fox is going to reach out to you.
You think it's going to be Fox, though? Fox doesn't have me on nearly as much as CNN does.
If it's CNN, then I'll give you the green light. But when Fox does, I'm just going to... Although, you know, you could be part of the internal resistance at Fox. I think that could work, too. Everybody needs an internal resistance. Speaking of which, so yeah, let me ask you from your journalistic perspective. I want to talk about this op-ed. I mean, like, it's caused... Susan and I talked about it last week. In fact, it broke on the day that we were recording, I think, if I remember correctly. What is, from your journalistic perspective, who do you think it is? Who's the culprit here?
You know, if I were to say honestly with a gun pointed in my head, I would say it's somebody that we know little about or possibly have never heard about. The person in the New York Times, or at least the disclaimer, said it's someone who's a senior official in the Trump administration. You know, anyone can be a senior official. It doesn't have to be the top tier cabinet secretary. It could be someone who, you know, maybe is an undersecretary or someone who is a deputy. You know, these are people who...
It's got to be somebody who can grab a document off of his actual desk in the Oval Office, right? I mean, that's...
Well, I'm trying to recall. Anybody. I'm trying to recall because, you know, between the anonymous op-ed and the Bob Woodward book, you know, it seemed that the recurring theme between the two of those is that there is like internal factions that are resisting against Trump's agenda. And I'm trying to recall in the anonymous op-ed if there was anything that suggested that the person who wrote it was taking documents off of his desk.
Maybe I'm confusing that information because all came out at the same time.
Yeah, because in the Woodward book, it opens up in the prologue, and this excerpt made it was published in, I think, the Washington Post, about Rob Porter, the staff secretary, and Gary Cohn, who is the former chief of the National Economic Council in the White House. Basically, you know, they formed the team and they would take off any documents on Trump's desk that were to be signed. And the one in question is the Korean Free Trade Agreement. So it's the free trade agreement that the United States has with South Korea. And Trump wanted to pull out of it, not realizing the national security implications that may have because
– who put it on his desk? That's what I wanted to know.
Well, the thing is like Rob Porter – and you'll see this when you read the World War book. I'm in the middle of it now. But he would basically do his duties up until a point and then strategically get the document off his desk. So like Gary Cohn and Rob Porter kind of worked in tandem as a team to basically say that they're doing their jobs and then boom, like the document's disappeared. It's vanished. So like the policy can't go through. So So Rob Porter would put the document on his desk and then Gary Cohn would take it off.
Wow.
Yeah, that's so it's a fascinating
crazy
book. You know,
so you got an early copy of it. Right? Does it come out today?
It comes out on Tuesday, September 11th.
The day we drop this episode, it'll be out. I have ordered a copy, but you got an early copy. Are you writing about the book?
I am.
You were tweeting about it.
Yeah, I wanted to keep a running tab of all the notes that came out just because there's so much stuff that can that you can miss. And I wanted to make sure at least the things that were big takeaways, things that were not really reported on or underreported or possible, it could be myth, You know, there are a few quotes that Mattis said. You know, a lot of actually a lot of people who were responding to the book saying that things were untrue, but I'd say like 90% of it is probably factually accurate.
But let me ask you something.
Sure.
Did you burn your Nikes this week?
I drone striked them.
You drone striked them. Okay.
I used a Predator drone and I bombed the shit out of my Nikes. Mostly Nikes. I have a pair of KDs, Kevin Durant's, a pair of Jordans, and two pairs of Kyrie Irving. So, yeah, I drone strike the shit out of them because Nike disrespects my country and my flag.
You know what? I realized that I own two pairs of New Balance.
Oh,
and
look at you.
I'm going to have to – I got to like buy a drone now because I got to do this right.
Well, why do you got to drone strike your New Balances?
Aren't they like the new sneaker of fascism or something? That's what I heard. I heard that they were taking up – they're the counter Nike. Is that not true?
I have never heard that.
It could be a troll tweet, but I did see that circulating that New Balance is going to be the shoe of the white supremacy. But
I might want to double check it before I tell them. This was back in like November of 2016. Neo-Nazis in the Washington Post – neo-Nazis have declared New Balance the official shoes of white people.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
I didn't even know about that, but maybe I'll set them on fire in my kitchen sink or something.
Because New Balance was the first major sportswear company to publicly back president-elect Donald Trump, and then everybody started burning their New Balance. So, this really came full circle. I can't believe it. Well, I'm going to have to hop on Twitter later on and be like, hey, remember when everybody burned their New Balance?
I'll donate my New Balance.
Why?
And buy some Nike.
Who cares? I feel better about it.
They're pretty gross, though. I've had them for a while. I don't even use them that much because, you know, I don't work out very often.
Okay. If you want to make excuses for why you're getting rid of your New Balance, just go ham with it. Just say you're, you know, anti-Trump resistance, F Trump, you know, go burn them.
That's true. At least I'll get a viral tweet out of it.
You know,
but
just do it and be a legend, man.
Are you watching the NFL? Are you also like boycotting the NFL?
No. Why would I do that? Why would I torture myself like that? I'm a huge New England Patriots fan. I have friends who are Baltimore Ravens fans, and I went to school with them at college, and they were protesting the NFL because of Colin Kaepernick not getting a position in the NFL. And I was like, how convenient of you to, you know, diss the NFL just when your team sucks ass. And of course, me being a Patriots fan, they think I'm also pro-Trump and a big Republican. So they're just, you know, talking shit back.
Well, I have a sneaking suspicion that a lot of people are just secretly watching it anyways.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, the ratings this past weekend, they actually did better than in previous years. I mean, in three out of the four time slots, they actually performed better than in 2017. So, you know, Trump tweeted about the NFL ratings being down. But just that was after one game. It was after a Thursday night game that was delayed due to weather. And, you know, that already hurts ratings right off the bat. Like, the later a game goes, more people go to sleep on the East Coast. It just happens that way. So, and plus, I hate the Eagles and I hate the Falcons. So, like, I wasn't going to watch anyways. And I have family
you know
in town,
what?
So I couldn't watch. I couldn't watch it.
They're all the same to me, but the politics of this is kind of crazy. I wonder if at any time before this administration, has any president use sports as a political, you know,
I would say Obama has
vehicle.
Obama has used it as
how?
A vehicle,
when?
But not in the way that Trump has used it. Obama's used it in a way of like bridging the gap to try to connect with people because he was one of the first. I don't know if Bush really, you know, pushed this out, but Obama was really like into college basketball. And, you know, he had a segment on SportsCenter on ESPN in which he would be filling out a NCAA men's basketball tournament bracket.
I remember
like,
that.
He would do that in order to try to, you know, build up his base, try to connect with other voters. And people really liked it. And, you know, I thought it was kind of cool that he was so into sports as much as like any other. I don't think any other president was as big into sports as he was. So, yeah, like Obama used sports, but just in a completely different way.
It was like in the spirit of good sportsmanship, right? Like enjoying sports.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know,
not like this.
This is interesting. I mean, when it comes to politics, you know, it's not about, you know, so much about policy, so much it is as you can connect with that person, as you can trust that person. And when people see that a politician is human, they take up the same interests that you do, whether it be sports, whether it be, you know, outdoor stuff, you know, what have you. If someone says, I can grab a beer with that person, then that's someone that they can trust and they'll probably vote for them.
Do you really think Trump supporters look at Trump and think, I can get a beer with that guy? That guy with the gold.
Oh, yeah. There are tons of them that think that. I mean, just think of the people that actually support him. You know, think of the blue collar workers in, you know, West Virginia or Ohio.
What on earth do they have in common with this man?
I think it's because he talks so much shit. And I think they like that.
He just talks shit.
Yeah, it's not so much a class thing, because Trump is a very white collar guy, but somehow he's been able to connect with all these blue collar voters in middle America because he has no filter. And I think a lot of, you know, rural Americans have no filter either. They don't give a shit about political correctness. They just, you know, say what's on their mind, and you know, whether they're full of shit or they're exaggerating or straight up lying, you know, there's some level of truth to that. So I don't know.
Hey, guys, I am once again going to tell you about the one and only vitamin that I have started taking about 2 months ago and has made such a tremendous difference to my life, to my health, to my well-being. I'm talking about Ritual. Okay, look, I'm 44 years old. I have spent most of my adult life taking care of kids, taking care of family, taking care of others, and not taking care of myself. And I know a lot of working mothers do the same thing. I end up buying drawers full of vitamins. I end up getting the skincare regimes. I think I'm going to do all this. And you know what? The time, the energy, the effort, just remembering to do it, it's nearly impossible. That's why I love Ritual. It is 2 pills a day, anytime I want during the day. There's no other pill to take. I am done. It has made my vitamin taking so much easier. I'm literally actually taking vitamins. Really, for the first time in my life, I've never regularly taken vitamins. I just couldn't deal with all the pills, but that's all I need now, just Ritual. I have tried taking, like for example, the omega-3 pills. I can't stand those. They taste awful. They taste like fish oil. Come on, y'all know what I'm talking about. Well, Ritual has these beautiful capsule that, I don't even know how to explain it. It's a capsule that has all these little capsules in it, and you never taste the omega-3. It tastes like mint, okay? They have all the vitamin D I need, and I need a lot of vitamin D because I don't get out in the sun very much. I am committed for the long term for Ritual. Like I said, it's been about 2 months. My third bottle, I just got the email that it's coming in the mail. I am telling all the women in my life that I love and care about, especially women who are in their late 30s, early 40s, who are finally getting around to taking care of themselves, to please give this a try, okay? And if you've got more questions, you just gotta visit the website. You're learning everything about why every single ingredient in Ritual is beneficial, not only to us, but to where it's sourced from, okay? Ritual, it's made in the USA. There's no synthetic fillers. There's no colorants. It is vegan. It is sugar-free. It is non-GMO. It is gluten-free. It is allergen-free. It is a miracle in a little pill, okay? I mean, that's not an endorsement from them. I'm telling you, that's how I feel. It is hard to find a vitamin that is like this, all right? And it's subscription-based. There's no gap in your nutrient level. It will come to your door every single month. $30 a month, that is $1 a day delivered to your door. Once again, if you buy just one of these vitamins that are in Ritual, like just buy the omega-3 alone monthly, that costs more than Ritual itself. Your happiness is guaranteed, and you can cancel easily any single time. Look, 95% of women don't get the vitamins and minerals they need on a daily basis. Finally, we have Ritual. They created a smarter vitamin with the 9 essential ingredients that women lack most. So go to ritual.com/45th today. Choose clean ingredients backed by science and sign up right now at ritual.com/45th. And then don't forget to reach out to me on social media and tell me how great you feel. There's a few stories this week I wanted to talk to, but I just saw a tweet about an hour ago saying that I think it's been like 2 weeks since there's been like since Sanders, Huckabee Sanders call has had a press briefing. Is that right? You remember the press.
I am not 100% sure, as I haven't really been following the press briefings as closely. I guess there's not a whole lot of weight that's been given to the press briefings, because it's really just a time for, you know, the White House to
rallies.
Stifle
Trump rallies.
Well, no, it's a chance for the White House to stifle He's any still, like media questioning, and it's a spin cycle.
I mean, that going that long, especially given, you know, the Kavanaugh hearings, there's so much happening. I mean, like, you know, the book, the op-ed, basically just making yourself unavailable.
Yeah. And, I understand that in the last couple of weeks, it probably hasn't been a good time to host any press briefings between, you know, I don't think the Trump White House wants to distract from the Kavanaugh hearings. I think they want to focus on that. And if Sarah Huckabee Sanders were to hold a press briefing after the anonymous op-ed in the New York Times and the Bob Woodward book, that I think they would probably add more fuel to the fire of media speculation about the truthfulness, or who wrote the anonymous op-ed, or what is actually accurate in the World War book. And I don't think they want to have that. I don't think they want to give any more life to those stories. Just from a pure communications perspective, like, if you're looking to tamper down on a story that's portraying your organization or your administration as in a negative light, like the media does every day with the Trump administration, you want to try to clamp that down as much as possible. By not addressing it at all, you're doing everything you can already do.
Well, there are other things happening in the world. I mean, there are other issues in the world that need to be addressed. And so just because there's an op-ed or a bad book about your president, I don't think it's a fair shot to just shut down all media access to the White House.
But the media really latches on to the salacious and sensational stories. And if there's something that happens behind the scenes in the White House that can be construed as something that's like just so out of this world crazy. I mean, just look at what happened with the Michael Wolff cycle. You know, there were, you know, the Gorilla Channel. Remember that?
Right.
And the whole, I mean, that was the biggest. I can't remember everything else that came from it, but there were just so many things that were just so ridiculous. You're like, how is this even real? And I don't think the White House really played well to try to clamp that down. And so, you know, people are going to buy this World War book, and I don't know if it will meet the sales that Michael Wolff did. But I think Woodward is far and away a more credible reporter than Michael Wolff.
You know what? Why don't we just get into the book then?
Okay.
Because we keep bringing it up. Let's go there. Let's go there, because this is clearly there's a lot there. Okay. I want to – you just said that you think it's not going to outsell the Wolff book. And
I'm not saying it's not going to. I just am not certain, because there were so many more crazier things that were written about in the Michael Wolff book than there are in the Woodward book.
But, Woodward is a much more respected, I think, journalist, right? I mean,
right.
He's kind of a chronicler of the presidency, right?
Yeah.
Tell me, I didn't read the Wolff book. I bought it. I didn't read it. What is kind of the difference here? Like, is it the sourcing is different? Is it the kind of content that's different? Was that just more salacious? Like, what do you think are the fundamental differences between the two books, first of all?
Having not read the Michael Wolff book.
Never mind.
No, it's just – I mean, like, I'm only highlighting certain excerpts from the Michael Wolff book. I was going to read it. I was told it was not worth my time, just because there's so many typos and factual errors in it that I wasn't going to really learn anything. I think the Bob Woodward book is a lot more insightful just right off the bat, from not having looked at any excerpts or not having read the Michael Wolff book, just on its face. Really, it's more, I think, more about storytelling in general, because there are several recurring themes in the Woodward book. It starts off really with dropping you into the 2016 election in August of 2016, so right when Bannon entered the picture. And by the accounts of a lot of the people that are, you know, cited or quoted in the book, you can tell that Woodward spoke a lot with Steve Bannon, who I guess is accused of leaking a lot to the press. He spoke a lot with Rob Porter, H.R. McMaster, Reince Priebus, probably Kellyanne Conway. And, you know, he kind of starts off.
He spoke with them and he recorded them all, too,
yeah.
Right? I mean, this
yeah.
is all, yeah.
Yeah, no, I have no doubt that, like, most of the things that were like the longer stories of like focusing on Bannon. I think that the stuff like that is probably more accurate, because Bannon is not really portrayed in a negative light in this book so much as he's just, you know, his actual views are portrayed. So, you know, the nationalistic America first, the wanting to really clamp down on illegal and legal immigration, implementing trade wars. I mean, if Bannon did not join the campaign in August of 2016 as the executive chairman, Trump would have dropped out of the race as soon as that Access Hollywood tape dropped, because Bannon was the only person. Yeah, so Bannon was the only person telling Trump to stay in the race, and everybody was telling him to drop out. You know,
given that, I'm surprised that he got rid of him.
It wasn't Trump who got rid of Bannon.
The buck stops at Trump, right?
But it was John Kelly who fired him.
I mean, it was, but if Trump wasn't okay with that, that wouldn't have happened, right? I mean, like,
yeah,
Kelly,
I guess
his,
so. I mean, right? I don't know. I think I have yet to get to the part where Bannon's actually fired.
Okay.
But I'm like in the summer of 2017 right now, so I'm like midway through it. I'll probably get it done by the time this recording actually goes out or gets published. But really, what's interesting though is that, you know, with the whole part about Bannon pushing Trump to stay in the race, he was the only one who said, "I 100% believe you're going to win this race," because he was shifting the strategy from, you know, focusing on his policy to just hammering Hillary, just, you know, demonizing her, you know, broad brushing her and basically connecting her to the coastal elite, someone who's out of touch with the American voter or the average American. And
also painting her like somebody who might be sick. Remember all that stuff, the cough and the stumble and the this and that?
Yeah. I mean, like when she got sick on September 11th, they didn't hammer that as much with her fitness after the Access Hollywood tape. They really focused on her being just incredibly corrupt and out of touch, and somehow that really worked for him.
Does Bannon acknowledge the tape is real?
Which tape?
The Access Hollywood tape.
I believe so. I have to go back and actually look and see, but I think he the way that he was initially spinning it is that, you know, those are just words. What Bill Clinton actually did was action. It was a whole lot worse. And so he was the one who came up with the idea. I wouldn't say it was Bannon, but it was a combined effort. And I think it was inspired by Bannon to get Bill Clinton's accusers to that second presidential debate. Because you remember right before the second presidential debate in 2016, you know, they brought in Juanita Broderick, Paula Jones, I don't think they didn't bring in Monica Lewinsky, but they brought in two other Bill Clinton accusers, and they had basically they surprised the press with a press conference saying what Bill Clinton actually did, and then they sat in the audience during the second presidential debate, and
yeah,
that like changed, and that changed the entire narrative, or at least it stopped the bleeding for Trump. And he was able to kind of turn the page and turn the corner and focus on hammering Hillary for basically remaining at Bill Clinton's side while he was doing all this stuff. It's a wild read in that
regard.
You know,
it's interesting. I mean, whenever I think about that, I always think about the fact that I don't think there has been a wholesale assault on Melania the way there has been on Hillary Clinton for remaining in a marriage that is clearly marred by all kinds of sexual indiscretions.
Yeah, you know, so there's there was an interesting tidbit I remember from the Access Hollywood bit about what they were originally going to try to do to get Trump to get on this apology tour. And the very first thing was getting him on the couch with Melania Ivanka, basically Trump crying and apologizing to them in front of like 60 minutes. And Melania just shot that down outright. She's like, no, there's not going to be anything like that.
I can't imagine Trump even like faking that. He couldn't have done that. He couldn't have gotten through that.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, I don't think so either. But you know, I don't know what their situation is. At least according to the World War book, you know, they have between Melania and Donald, there's some deep affection between them, despite what media reports have been saying. But apparently, 100% of her effort has been focused on Barron. And I don't know if Melania and Donald have an arrangement, but I'm sure there is something that has remained in place so that they can still remain together. And also the fact that she's the first lady right now, it's kind of hard to make that into a public debacle without having Donald come after her.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, when Hillary was first lady, I don't think that it didn't seal her away from any of those attacks at that time either, if I remember correctly. But, you know, to me, on one hand, you have the fact that there are sexual indiscretions and then there are sexual assaults, right? Like there are things that happen in a marriage that are in the, that I think are between a husband and wife to try to work out. And then there are like crimes against women, such as sexual assaults. And I think they have to be addressed differently. Now, in both of these presidencies, it seems like these things happened. But so tell me, what about the Woodward book do you think might be a little bit fudged, might be questionable?
You know, Trump was disputing about the way he talks. And I don't know.
That's exactly how he talks.
Yeah, like the thing is, like, you know, he and Gary Cohn, they kind of had like a buddy-buddy relationship. And I think there was probably – I don't think anything so far in the book has really stuck out to me as being inaccurate. It's possible that there are things that happened in the book that may have been exaggerated, but there's nothing that really raised my eyebrows right now. I'm just kind of giving a 10% like uncertainty that there might be a part of it that might be not true or factually inaccurate. And that's just, you know, gut feeling. I just don't want to say all of it is true because I don't know it is.
So this book is not going to bring down this presidency.
Well, no, I don't think so. Well, I'm trying to remember. When Woodward and Bernstein wrote All the President's Men, was that what brought down Nixon?
I think that did set into motion a lot of the stuff. I don't know enough about.
Yeah, you know, I don't know.
As a child, but I do think it was a very integral part of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it has that level of impact. I think
even though it probably has allegations that are even more serious. In many respects, I would say. But
well, it depends on the allegations. I don't know exactly what allegations. I mean, like Trump railed against Sessions for pretty much ever since he recused himself in the Russia investigation and brought up a special counsel. Like, I mean, like, according to his reporting, there's not so much anything about like obstruction of justice or possibly getting into a perjury trap. Right now, it's pretty much the phase in which he's just – incensed by what Sessions did to him, and he's incensed by the actions of Rod Rosenstein.
Is there any report? Well, that's just like an ongoing phenomenon at this point. But is there any sense in the book, is there any reporting in the book about Trump's like mental state of mind? You know, I mean, like Omarosa, of course, I don't give her a lot of credibility, but many others also, and I think people who have been watching him over the years, or the last 15, 20 years, also seem to sense that there is a decline in his like cognitive ability and his speech. I mean, like, did you see that?
I haven't
part in the
seen
rally
that. I
last week.
I haven't seen that addressed at all in the book.
Where he said he couldn't say the word anonymous. Did you
anonymous.
See that? He couldn't say it twice. He couldn't say it. And
I don't know if that's a president. I don't know if that's a signal that he's not fit to be president. I mean, anonymous. For some people, I'm sure it's a
tricky word.
I'm
not saying not fit to be president. I'm talking about it seems like there's something wrong. Something is happening with him, like mentally. But there's no such reporting in the book about those kinds of things.
Not that I've seen, no. Okay. So far, the only mental fitness that is mentioned in the book is Trump kind of chiding Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross for kind of losing it mentally. And Wilbur Ross is only like 8 years older or 7 or 8 years older than Trump. He's like 79, 80 years old.
But he seems exponentially more competent. Like, we're wrong here.
When you only have to run one agency instead of the entire country, I can imagine your job is a little bit
Trump easier. Is running in nothing but his bedroom, okay, in a robe and with a Big Mac. He's not – this man, what does he do? He goes from rally to rally. Like, what work is he actually doing? He tweets all day. Really, he's like he's a total bum. I don't think he is. I don't think he's running anything. I think what's happening is what we heard about in that op-ed, where you've got like this shadow team. You've got this team of people who are just trying to keep the country afloat, despite this president, not because of him. I don't know.
Anyway. I mean, I guess
book,
go off if you
read
want.
It.
I was just going to say that, I mean, I don't know what the job of president really entails because only 44 people have held the post beforehand. So I'm going to hold out.
I'll tell you this. I know it starts with daily briefings, reading for hours. Like, you know what I mean? Connecting with international figures, making – I mean, like, it involves a lot of, like, just learning stuff, right? I mean, yeah, that's something Trump outright rejects.
Yeah, Trump doesn't want to learn. But I was just going to say, you know, there were also in an age where nothing matters. So you just got to pick your battles, really.
Can I ask you, Suraj?
Sure.
Do you hope to go back to a time when stuff does matter?
Well, define what matters, because there are things that –
I mean, just the kind of presidency we've always had. Presidents that have, like, schedules we all – you know, that are made public every day. They make public appearance. We know what their schedule – they have daily intelligence briefings.
Oh,
they
so
have,
you wanted to go back to being boring.
Oh, my God. I want the office of presidency to be maybe as efficient as, like, a high school principal's office. I mean, like, to be as professional as that, as scheduled and, you know, transparent. But
no,
boring is not the way I ever saw it.
So, well, that's how I guess a lot of people in the media would respond to it. Because, I mean, yes, if you are just observing everything from afar, you would think everything is terrible. I guess I'm in a unique position where everything is just so crazy that it's pretty entertaining. And I don't know if I ever – there will be a period where we go back to, like, you know, we will resume.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, this is a great time for journalists, definitely.
Yeah.
Because there's so many stories.
Okay. Absolutely.
Well, speaking of that, let's get into some of the stories from this past week. I wanted to talk a little bit – we haven't talked about immigration, I think, in a couple of weeks in this show. Just touching base because, you know, it kind of devolves a little bit further. We've been following the story about, you know, children who are separated from parents and the administration attempting to follow court orders and reunite them. There are still over 400 children that are separated from their parents. About 14 of them are under the age of 5. Apparently, many of those parents have already been removed, deported, or are otherwise ineligible to be reunited. So those kids are still there, but there's a new announcement this week, which is raising concerns of immigration advocates, and that is this, that this past Thursday, they announced a rule that they would allow immigrant children to be held with their parents in detention indefinitely. And now, if you think about kind of like the evolution of this, what was happening was, you know, they're separating the kids from the parents. The court's like, can't do that, got to keep them together. But when you do that, when parents are being held with kids, there's something called the Flores settlement from, I think, 1997 that requires that children not be held for more than 20 days when they're detained like that. And so this is a settlement the federal government had entered into after being sued all the way up to the Supreme Court. And basically the administration is saying, we are no longer going to honor this settlement and we are going to exercise our right to hold children indefinitely along with their parents. Anything you've heard of further on this as a journalist?
This has been one of those stories that's kind of been buried ever since, in July we were last talking about it?
It's been a while.
Yeah. No, it's been a couple of months to say the least. Yeah, you know, it's a tough situation because I feel for these kids and these families, and I understand that there's the onus is on the government to try to reunite families to – if they are legitimate families. You know, there are plenty of, I mean, you as an immigration lawyer, you know very well that there are plenty of children who come in to the country. If they either cross illegally or on their own, unaccompanied, or they come in through smugglers, you always have to put the safety of the child above. And honestly, I don't know as much as you do in terms of what's happening on the ground, because we certainly haven't been hearing much about it. But, you know, with this indefinite detention of families, this new ruling that you're talking about, we're not ruling, but new rule. It falls in line with Trump's policy and his administration of not doing catch and release. And immigration is a complex subject that I don't agree with the administration on, because I feel like there's a more humane way of carrying these things out. And I understand that they're trying to reduce illegal border crossings. But I just have to say that the one thing that if Trump really wanted to just curb illegal immigration, at least through the southern border, would be to build a wall. But he seems to not have his focus on that. And I understand that there's plenty of people who overstay visas. And I know that there are plenty of people who are smuggled into the country via ship from Asia, or they come into the country, you know, like I said, overstaying visas, and they just never go. But this constant demonization of, you know, they had the Molly Tibbet story, you know, the young 20-year-old University of Iowa student who was killed by an undocumented immigrant who was staying on the farm of a GOP fundraiser. And they immediately latched onto that story to say that all immigrants, you know, paint the picture that all immigrants who came into the country illegally are evil and want to bring in crime.
They're dangerous.
But
yeah.
Of course, like if you look at, but if you look at the numbers, obviously, you know, this, you know, if you look at the numbers, crime actually went down between 1980 and 2016. As immigrants were coming into the country, that number was going up. Violent crime specifically went down by 36%, according to the FBI.
Right. I mean, generally speaking, immigrants, documented or undocumented, commit crimes at lower rates. Of course, there are situations in which you have gang members and other things, but that's a criminal entity that is not like the average immigrant, documented or undocumented. This man who was arrested in the death of Molly Tibbet apparently was a farm worker. A lot of the farm forces hire these people. Now, according to his employer, he was verified through a system called E-Verify. Mm-hmm. But it seems like what was happening was, so, you know, he initially, his lawyer said, well, no, he was verified, so he was not undocumented. He actually, it seems like he was undocumented. He was using somebody else's credentials. Oh, I think somebody else's work authorization number, which is possible to do. And also, I don't know to what extent the employer actually did do the process, because there are plenty of employers who don't always comply. I mean, and it's hard to keep up with, especially migrant seasonal farm workers who switch out constantly and sometimes even pass the credentials around. But most of the time what's happening here is that they're living in terrible conditions, so they can pick our flipping strawberries and radishes for like $2 an hour. That's like the worst of their crimes. Now, in this situation, I will say this, as somebody who in my other life, outside of the 45th, works on Undisclosed, which is a wrongful conviction podcast, I have looked, and I've been working with a journalist. We've been looking at some of the facts of this case, and I am a little bit skeptical, actually, about his involvement. There are things that are not adding up.
Yeah, no, I definitely. Yeah. I mean, I didn't want to bring it up because I wasn't sure about the credibility of it. But since you brought it up, what have you been hearing?
Well, I mean, in terms of like how her body was found, it was found a number of days later in an area that had already been searched. It had been found in a place where, if she really had been out there that long, you would have expected some animal activity. His confession, we have done so many cases now that involve wrongful confessions. His confession sounds like a classic wrongful confession, which is, number one, there's language issues, but number two, it keeps changing. You know, he says, yes, I did it. I did it like this. The police are like, no, that's not how it happened. Give us a different story. He gives them a different story. Like it sounds like a very typical wrongful confession story. And given that, and given the fact that I don't think her body was out there that long, I think it was moved there shortly before it was discovered. Mm-hmm. I think something's wrong off. And that's the extent that I know. And if you know anything else, I'd love to hear.
No, I mean, like I definitely think that there are facts that aren't adding up to the story. You know, some of it is definitely missed on me. But I definitely think there was foul play, but I don't know if he was the one involved. And it's possible he's being the scapegoat in this case. So it's possible. I'm not saying it's definite. The guy's been charged. Yeah. I mean, I guess it just got to wait for the legal or justice system to play out. But, you know,
What worries me is that if this thing doesn't go to trial, if he takes a plea, because that happens a lot. I mean, I think like 97% of cases in federal court are pled out, 93% in state cases. A lot of people just fold under the plea because they don't have the means for the litigation. Mm-hmm. They're told, well, you can go to court, you can go to trial and face, let's say, life sentence or a death sentence, or you can take a plea and take like 25 years, right?
Yeah.
One way or the other, I feel like if he's forced into a plea, it's going to be much harder to figure out what actually happened. If it goes to trial and he has a decent defense attorney, then maybe they'll raise a defense well enough that can challenge the state's theory of the case. But there's already an immigration detainer on him. One way or the other, once the criminal justice system is done with him, he'll just simply be removed. He'll be deported. So Lately, I have been trying to teach my kids some better eating habits. I confess, I have a daughter in college, and I was really young when I had her, so I didn't do such a great job, but I've been much more thoughtful with my younger kids. I had my 9-year-old in my 30s, and you know, she watches me as I try to make better eating choices, and she's awesome because she loves to try new things. Lately, we both have started eating RX bars, and we have a pantry full of all kinds of protein bars, but these are now my go-to bar. The RX bar is a whole food protein bar, okay? So this is what that means. The bar is made with 100% whole ingredients. Every single ingredient is listed right there. You can pronounce it, you can identify it. The core ingredients are egg whites, dates, and nuts, which is why they're also delicious. I love them. My 9-year-old loves them. She asked for them specifically, so what I do is I give her the RX bar for kids. That's exactly. They've made a special bar that's just for kids. Once again, a clean label snack bar, egg whites, fruits, nuts is the base. They have 7 grams of protein, absolutely zero added sugar, no gluten, no soy, no dairy, no bad stuff. They are delicious, they're convenient. My daughter loves them. And by the way, it fills her up and gives her energy. She is a rambunctious little girl. The RX Bar Kids come in 4 flavors. There's peanut butter and jelly, chocolate chip, a favorite for my daughter, apple cinnamon raisin, and berry blast. Right as school starts, RX Bar is going to be debuting 2 new flavors, right? Now, if you're familiar with the mainline RX Bar, these kid bars have the same whole food ingredients. They're just a little bit smaller, kid-friendly flavors. The texture's a little softer. The nuts are a little bit smaller. And they're just perfect. They're perfect for kids on the go. The PB&J flavor make a perfect breakfast with a glass of milk, and it takes minutes, which, you know, you don't have a lot of time in the morning, so it works out great. Now, RX Bar is offering an exclusive pack of 6 adult bars and 4 kid bars, so the whole family is able to enjoy. To get 25% off your first order, all you gotta do is go to rxbar.com/45th and enter the promo code 45th at checkout. Once again, that is rxbar.com/45th and enter the promo code 45th at checkout. Some other news that came out today has to do with Palestinians. It just seems like this ongoing onslaught against the Palestinians. It's been one thing after another this whole summer. We began the summer with the embassy, U.S. embassy being moved to Jerusalem, obviously in direct contravention to the concerns and desires of Palestinians, Palestinian Authority, because, you know, they consider Jerusalem to be disputed territory and a future capital, shared capital. And the U.S. basically, Trump said, nope, this is the capital of Israel, and so we're moving our embassy there, began there. Then they completely defunded the U.N. Refugee and Works, I think, that's what it's called, Refugee and Works Agency that funds Palestinian aid, completely, like $300 million defunded it. Then last week, I think there was an announcement that there was like another like $20 or $25 million that was set aside to help fund the East Jerusalem Hospital Network. It involves 6 hospitals. It serves over 5 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. Trump said, we're going to take away the funding from that. And then today comes the announcement that the office of the PLO in D.C., the PLO mission in D.C. is going to be shuttered. They're not going to let them operate anymore here.
Oh, the government ruled that?
They announced that today, that no longer is the PLO going to be able to operate here. So this is like a part of I think the strategy here, and I know like Jared Kushner is very much involved in this, is to strong arm the Palestinians, basically take everything off the table, just crush them and corner them to the point where they would be willing to take just a deal, any kind of deal to get relief, I think. What do you think is going on?
Well, I mean, like, since I'm kind of just learning about this now, I'm sort of, you know, trying to process it as well on the fly. I probably would agree with you in the sense that they're trying to stranglehold the Palestinians in a way that makes any deal that the White House offers to them the best option possible. And it's like, it's basically like starving any person of food and then offering them a Ritz cracker after like 10 days. Of course, you're going to take the Ritz cracker and eat it. You know, it may not be the best thing that they could put into a system at that moment, but that's probably what they're going to end up doing. I don't know. It's
I certainly don't think the Palestinians are going to take the Ritz cracker. I think the Palestinians for 70 years have said we're not taking nothing less than what we need to survive.
But they were accepting American federal dollars. At least the Palestinian Authority was.
Of course, yeah. So they also get a tremendous amount of aid from, you know, across the world, from the Middle East as well, you know, other parts of the world.
No, I know, Europe. I'm just saying that the Palestinian Authority was still taking American taxpayer dollars for whatever reason. I don't know how they were appropriating the money, and I guess Trump saw that as all that money was, or most of that money, or some of that money was going to the families of Hamas terrorists, and I guess that's what the reason why he pulled the plug on it. Again, like the Palestinian Authority has been ransacked with Hamas officials, and there's obviously been collusion or at least cooperation between the two parties in trying to maintain a level of power within the Palestinian government. And I don't think Hamas has any intention of operating in good faith or trying to protect its people. I think they honestly are trying to ensure that they remain in power by making themselves out to look like martyrs to the rest of the world.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, let's see, I was in Israel. I can't remember what year it was. It was a few years ago. And at the time, while I was there, the Palestinian Authority and Hamas, just for folks to understand, the West Bank is ruled by the Palestinian Authority. Gaza, the Gaza Strip, is ruled by Hamas. They were democratically elected. At that time, Hamas has entered into talks with the Palestinian Authority. And these are factions that are like basically they're you know, opposition factions. They hate each other. But they were going to enter into something called the unity government. And in this agreement, Hamas had said, OK, we're going to basically accept the terms of the Palestinian Authority. We'll enter into one, you know, collaborative government that will help basically distribute like paying people. You know, they were having trouble getting like in Gaza Strip. They couldn't get like payments to people, you know, like just employees paying civil workers, all those kinds of things. And they said that, you know, we'll even accept the terms of the Palestinian Authority vis-a-vis Israel, meaning accepting the right of Israel to exist, blah, 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 all those other things. These talks are ongoing, and that's when Israel, a couple of things happened. They were kids or something. They disappeared. They were attacked, I think two boys or something. And I actually was still there when this was happening. And then they launched like a full-scale assault on Gaza and like killed like 1,000 children. And so that basically, you know, so when it comes to Hamas, you know, it's kind of like damned if you do, damned if you don't, right? Like definitely Hamas, they have an interest in keeping the conflict alive that keeps them in power. It's not very different than kind of like what this administration is doing and by, you know, fear mongering and all that. They keep their population, I think, in peril by every so often launching these missiles that, you know, that do nothing for them. That, you know, they do not have the means to fight the Israeli army, but they just end up putting their own people in peril because the Israeli army comes back and decimates them.
I just want to push back on, I don't think it's really a fair comparison to compare the Trump administration to Hamas. That's a bit much.
No, I'm not comparing them to Hamas. What I'm saying is there is a tactic that governments will use, right? Like a fear. Like if you create enough fear, it will create support for you. This is like a tried and true. It happens like in every country. It happens in Pakistan, where I'm from. It happens all the time.
That's a better clarification of what you were just saying before. Because, yes, yeah. I understand that there is a need that governments push fear on the people to try to ensure that it solidifies their own power. And I get that.
I will also say this. Like, Gazans don't even really need Hamas to do that, right? I mean, like, we all know the situations of Gazans. I mean, like, obviously their lives are very much impacted by Israeli embargoes and stuff like that. So they don't even need a specter. They don't need fear-mongering. Like, their lives are hell anyways. The point being that I feel like even when Hamas was willing to work with Palestinian Authority, which would have been the right move, I think, for the Palestinian people, Israel wasn't having it because they don't want in any way or shape for Hamas to be legitimized. And I think that's the, you know, one of the complications here. But with Trump doing this, the response from the PLO basically has been, this is a quote, "The administration's reasoning for such an act is a refusal of the Palestinian leadership and the PLO delegation to the U.S. to cooperate with the so-called peace effort and our actions to hold Israel accountable by referring it to the International Criminal Court." And I'm going to talk about the ICC in a second, but the spokesperson said, "Our rights are not for sale. We will block any attempts at bullying, blackmailing us to forgo our legitimate and internationally endorsed rights. Now, this stuff happened right in the wake of a really alarming speech that Netanyahu gave last week. And in that speech, and then I think the Israeli foreign ministry like tweeted this part of the speech. This was the exact quote. In the Middle East and in many parts of the world, there is a simple truth. There is no place for the weak. The weak crumble, are slaughtered, and are erased from history, while the strong, for good or for ill, survive. The strong are respected, and alliances are made with the strong. And in the end, peace is made with the strong. That doesn't sound like a great omen.
That was Netanyahu's speech,
which are the Palestinians.
That was Netanyahu's speech, you said, right?
That was Netanyahu's speech. Yeah, he said that last Wednesday in a talk, and then the foreign ministry retweeted it. It got a lot of raised eyebrows, and people were kind of horrified by it, including by a lot of Israelis too, because you know it's very reminiscent of all kinds of like authoritarian rhetoric.
Yeah,
and I mean, basically, like, the weak crumble or slaughtered. I mean, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to I don't know what the Trump administration plans. And ensuring a Middle East peace deal. I know that he tabbed Jared Kushner to lead that effort, and we haven't really seen much progress. I don't know what the play is here. And I feel – I don't know what that option that the Trump administration is trying to give the Palestinians at this juncture, because any talk about a one-state or two-state solution immediately met with intense scrutiny whether you choose one or the other, and I have no idea what the actual solution should be, because I've never been to Israel. I don't know what the political dynamic is there. I don't know what the people are like there. I can only say from what I see from afar. So
it's so complicated and crazy. It's really an intense place. I did read an excellent piece a couple of weeks ago. This is an idea that's been floated a number of times about the idea of a federation of states, and I think that seems to be the only thing that would actually work in terms of giving both people peace and some measure of prosperity and a chance to actually live and thrive. But there has to be a will towards it, obviously. I don't think there's a will towards it. But anyway, I'm going to move on to the next story,
sure.
Which is about the International Criminal Court, because this relates to the Palestinian story. And I guess maybe to some extent came from that. Today, Michael Bolton, Mr. Mustache, he came down really hard on the International Criminal Court. First, I just want to tell our listeners what that is. It was founded in 2002. It's a permanent international criminal court that brings to justice the perpetrators of the worst crimes known to humankind. I mean, we've all heard of The Hague. So war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide. 124 nations are members of this court. They have signed on to the Rome Treaty, which brought this court into existence. The United States is not one of those countries. Neither is Israel. But the Palestinians and others have referred Israel and the U.S. to the court a number of times for war crimes. Now, today, Bolton said that the U.S. will use any means necessary to protect its citizens and allies from prosecution by the International Criminal Court. Basically, they said that they would use tariffs. They would freeze the assets of any of the prosecutors and judges involved. They would impose travel bans on people involved in bringing any prosecution of a war crime, genocide, crime against humanity against United States or its allies, meaning Israel specifically, he said. He said, we will ban its financial system. We will prosecute them in the U.S. criminal system. We'll do the same for any company or state that assists in an ICC investigation of Americans. So they will also sanction other nations further any prosecution of the United States or Israel. And this is like, it's pretty crazy. I mean,
yeah. I'm just, I've been out of the loop on it, but I'm just reading about it now.
In 2002, what we were talking about is post 9/11, right? Like, so
right.
This is the Bush era. It's the Bush era. Bush, obviously, with his war on terror already, is like a little bit worried. He doesn't want our military people, our service people, any U.S. officials or personnel to be implicated or prosecuted for crimes against humanity, war crimes, which I think you could make the argument that we have committed war crimes in our war on terror. So he refused to sign on. In the Obama administration, although they did not sign the treaty, they established a working relationship and said the United States would become an observer to this court, but basically getting closer to compliance with it. But the fact that there's only seven countries who are we're not going to be part of this. I mean, the only time a country wouldn't want to be part of this is when they think they would be at risk of being prosecuted here.
I mean, that's what all signs are kind of pointing towards. For sure. Yeah. I mean, the by not participating in it, I wouldn't say it's an admission of guilt, but they're definitely looking to not have it reach that. I wouldn't say it's maybe the closest thing to pleading the Fifth Amendment. You don't want to infringe on yourself, or you don't want to
You want to implicate yourself.
Implicate. That's it. Thank you.
Right. I mean, look, the U.S. actors and agencies and legal minds were instrumental in helping set up this court. They were very much part of the prosecutions after the Yugoslavia, the Bosnian War, Milosevic being held accountable for war crimes. But this is the double standard that we employ. We're we want Milosevic to go down for it, but we're not going to hold George W. Bush accountable for war crimes that he might be found guilty of by this court. But basically this is kind of the trend of this administration that it left the UN Human Rights Council, right? It's already threatened to pull out the World Trade Organization. It withdrew from the Paris Climate Agreement last year. You have basically diplomats and officials saying that basically we're becoming a pariah on the world stage. This is just one more step towards it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the tricky part you run into when it comes to, implicating George W. Bush is that you also had a congressional approval for the authorization of use of military force in Iraq. So if you implicate George W. Bush, you also have to implicate members of Congress who voted for the Iraq War. So, yeah, there would be many, many parties that I'm sure the ICC would target or prosecute.
The way it works is that, the ICC, a prosecutor there can decide who to charge. They don't have to charge every single – they don't have to charge –
No, that's true. But I guess if you want to be consistent about it, right. Every vote that went towards approving the use of military force in the Iraq War – is basically a lead up to a giant war crime. I was against the Iraq War when they initially were voting on it. I was only 14 at the time, 14 or 15. Mm-hmm. I obviously didn't have any public status at that time, but it's still on its face. I felt it was an unjust war and there was no reason for us to be there. So, if the ICC ends up prosecuting individuals because of the Iraq War, and if it's for good reason, then they should let that trial,
out. At this point, it's not even that we're we're just going to abstain from this. What's happening now, Bolton is we are basically – he's declaring war on the ICC, essentially.
Right.
We're going to prosecute you.
Well, that's only because Bolton – he was part of the Bush administration as the UN ambassador – and, he feels that the only way to stop, countries like Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons is just bomb the shit out of them. So, just think of where that type of sentiment is coming from.
It's just one more step towards, the U.S. becoming the kind of nation that it always said it wasn't.
Right.
And I think that's
definitely.
And one more step towards that, I think, is maybe the confirmation of Kavanaugh. And so we have about 5 minutes.
I'm gonna, really? Only five?
Sorry. I got to wrap up in five, maybe 10 minutes at the most. So let's talk about the Kavanaugh hearings a little bit. Not so much about, the meat and potatoes of the actual hearings, although there's a couple clips I want to play. But I want to talk about these emails that came out. Do you want to lead us into this? You know what I'm talking about? I also saw your comment on the draft that said, bullshit.
You lead into it because you know a little bit more about it than I do.
Kavanaugh had – there were confirmation hearings last week. I think they lasted 2 days.
3 days.
Right in the way – were they 3 days? Okay. He was asked about – there are a number of times he dodged a lot of questions. In fact, I'm going to – Kamala Harris – actually tweeted that he a number specifically he said he refused to answer whether the Supreme Court decision to make marriage legal was correctly decided. He refused to answer if he would recuse himself from any of the president's civil or criminal investigations. He refused to answer if he believed in Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, whether it was constitutional. And he refused to state whether Congress can ban abortions after 20 weeks or whether a state can outlaw common types. He was very evasive on certain questions. And then I want to play this clip for our listeners. There was a really testy exchange between him and Kamala Harris. And that is about the Mueller investigation. So,
Judge, have you ever discussed Special Counsel Mueller or his investigation with anyone?
Well, it's in the news every day.
Have you discussed it with anyone?
With other judges, I know.
Have you discussed Mueller or his investigation with anyone at Cassowitz, Benson & Torres, the law firm founded by Mark Cassowitz, President Trump's personal lawyer? Be sure about your answer, sir.
Well, I'm not remembering, but if you have something you want to...
Are you certain you've not had a conversation with anyone at that law firm? Cassowitz, Benson, and Torres, which is the law firm founded by Mark Cassowitz, who is President Trump's personal lawyer. Have you had any conversation about Robert Mueller or his investigation with anyone at that firm? Yes or no?
Well, is there a person you're talking about?
I'm asking you a very direct question, yes or no. Who'd you talk to?
I don't think I'm not remembering, but I'm happy to be refreshed, or if you want to tell me who you're thinking of.
Are you saying that with all that you remember, you have an impeccable memory? You've been speaking for almost 8 hours, I think more, with this committee about all sorts of things you remember. Yeah. How can you not remember whether or not you had a conversation about Robert Mueller or his investigation with anyone at that law firm? This investigation has only been going on for so long, sir. So
right, I'm not sure. I'm just trying to think. Do I know anyone who works at that firm? I might know.
That's not my question. My question is, have you had a conversation with anyone at that firm about that investigation? It's a really specific question.
I would like to know the person you're thinking of, because what if there's?
I think you're thinking of someone and you don't want to tell us.
It's horseshit.
Okay, let me ask you, what did you think about his response? Did it not seem like he is completely lying to her?
Oh, no. Well, it was vague and it could be misinterpreted in any number of ways. And the fact that she like continued on to belittle him, to claim that the question isn't complicated, offering to clarify the question, all the while pretending to be precise and then restating her original confusing line of inquiry almost verbatim. It's almost like a good
cop. You sound like a defense attorney. But here's the thing. Tell me what was confusing about it. Basically, she was like, did you have any conversation about the Mueller investigation with somebody from this law firm?
No, she started off originally like, did you talk about the Mueller investigation with anyone? And he's like, well, I talked with judges about it. And she's like, did you talk with anyone at Mark Cassowitz's law firm who's the attorney for President Trump? He's like, is there a specific person you had in mind? And she doesn't she doesn't have a person. Okay, she didn't name a person.
It doesn't matter. It's a specific question. It's a yes or no answer. Yes, I did or no, I didn't.
Well, it matters in terms of actual language because she doesn't name a specific person. She names.
She said anybody. She said anybody. And honestly,
he originally said he spoke with judges about it.
Judges aren't working at the law firm. The judges are not working at the law firm.
Yeah, but she diverges off to a point about the Cassowitz law firm. She diverges off to about the Cassowitz point of whether he spoke with anyone at the Cassowitz law firm and whether he knew if anyone that he spoke to in passing or in conversation over coffee or in, you know, more intense setting or more official capacity of anyone at the Cassowitz law firm. She didn't mention any name. So what is he going to say? He doesn't have to say anything that he doesn't know if he actually spoke with anyone at the Cassowitz law firm. I just think disingenuous.
I think it's a totally terrible defense. I think in any normal conversation, if I said, hey, did you talk to anybody at XYZ company about this? A normal person would say, Yes, I did. I spoke to this person, that person, that person. Or no, never. I mean, it's as simple as that. But beyond that, I thought it was so disingenuous how he was making it sound like he's never heard of the law firm. He's like, Casso? What? What? Who's that? His one of his closest buddies works at that firm. He knows that firm. And I thought that's what made it highly suspicious. It was so clear that he was trying to evade the question. It's so clear that she has proof that he did. And I don't know where that's going. But
What proof, though? What is the proof that she has that she spoke with?
Well, she's asking – the way she's – she was a prosecutor. You know that,
right?
I know she was
a California attorney general. And she was a DA at what's it called in San Francisco.
Right. That's how she's asking the question. That was a cross-examination. She was just like, I'm going to nail you. She's like, I have the proof. I'm going to see if you're going to tell me the truth or not.
Now, I honestly, anything that comes out of Kamala Harris, though, is really just a sign I'm running for president in 2020. So I don't think that this is something that's going to like be the nail in the coffin for Kavanaugh.
I don't think those things are mutually exclusive. You can run for president and you can also be somebody who's got proof that this guy is lying under oath at his confirmation hearing, just like
he not going to be a single prosecutor who's going to bring him up on perjury charges, if that's what you're wondering.
Well, right. Okay, so let's talk about this. There has been this complaint filed by, I think it's called the Democratic Committee or something like that. It's like a citizens group. I don't think it can actually – it doesn't work like that. They filed a complaint with the Department of Justice, I think this past week.
Oh, you're talking about Scott Dworkin and Democratic Coalition PAC? That bullshit?
That's what it is.
Yeah, that guy's a grifter. Yeah. That guy's
a
con artist.
Okay, the complaint is bullshit. The complaint itself, I don't think, has any – it procedurally cannot work because they cannot bring a complaint to the DOJ. DOJ has to – like, you know, federal officials have to bring those complaints to DOJ. However – the substance of the complaint, I think, is troubling. And that is that in 2004 and 2006, in two different confirmation hearings when he was being appointed to different benches, Kavanaugh lied in his confirmation hearings, specifically about a batch of emails that he was sent. And he got these emails. And shortly after he got these emails, it was discovered that the emails were stolen from the Senate Judiciary server. There was an actual investigation. It was very clear that these were stolen emails. He got them. But then when he was asked about it in 2004, 2006, he said, nope, I never got them. I never had them. And the thing is, nobody had the evidence there that he did have these documents that were stolen documents until now. Now these emails have come out showing that these documents were sent directly to him. It was clear that he had them, that he looked at them. So he lied in his confirmation hearings before.
So you think he willfully lied under oath as opposed to having an inconsistent testimony?
That's not – he's a judge, okay? Can I just tell you this? If I as a defendant did that, or if I as a witness did that in front of a judge, what he just did, that's an impeachable – I would be impeached as a witness. I mean, like, you no longer have credibility. So it's 2004 is not that far from 2002 for him to say he has no idea what documents are talking about. And these are not obscure documents. Again, there was an investigation. Literally, the sergeant at arms in the Senate seized these servers, right? Like, so this is like a big to do. This was opposition research that even the person who created those memos, the documents that were stolen, has written about this and said this is clearly stuff he knew that was stolen and not meant for him and people it was distributed to. So I think if I was a judge, I think if he was presiding over a case in which a witness did this, that person would be impeached. And I personally think as a lawyer, if a lawyer or a judge lies under oath, they should lose their license. So I do think this is a problem. I think it is completely unethical from a lawyer's perspective, from the oath of office we have to take. Even though I know you think it's bullshit.
Yeah, I do because, for one, I don't think he willfully lied under oath. And perjury is a very high standard that you have to meet to say that he knew willfully that he was saying something that was inaccurate or inconsistent.
He also, you know what could have happened? He can also go back and correct his testimony. Then it's not perjury anymore. But when you do make – when you make no corrections, you stand by your testimony and you lie. I mean, you know
– I don't think he's going to – well,
answer,
one, he's not going to do that.
He said, I don't recall. That's not perjury. If he said absolutely not, which is what he said, that's a lie. That is what perjury is.
Again, I'm not Brett Kavanaugh. I wasn't there during the hearings in 2002 and 2004. I was in high school, so I have
no idea what
happened.
They're on tape. You can go back and watch them.
I'll have to go back.
Anyway, all right, so we're going to wrap up. Let's see where this goes. I mean, I think there is a possibility that he might actually
be disqualified. He's getting confirmed for sure. Susan Collins already pre-vetted him, and she is basically the tie-breaking vote. He's getting confirmed for sure.
You can
take that to the bank.
I think we're in deep doo-doo if this guy gets confirmed. But on that note, I do want to wish our Jewish listeners and our Muslim listeners Happy New Year. Rosh Hashanah and the Muslim New Year have aligned yesterday. They've combined forces and begun at the same time. Our lunar calendars have combined.
That's right.
So enjoy. I wish you all a good New Year. I do believe it's a sign of the end of the times.
Happy New Year.
Anyway, Siraj, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you, Rabia.
Let's survive another week. All right.
We'll try.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.